Well, hi everybody, Father Alex here. Welcome to another episode of the Godcast. I am the vicar of St. Matthew's Church in Burnley. I'm also the host of the Godcast. I'm the author of Our Daily Bread from Argos to the Altar, A Priest's Story. You can find me on YouTube. You can find me on most social media platforms. You can follow me on X at AlexDJFrost. My guest today on the Godcast is Bishop Helen Ann Hartley, who is the Bishop of Newcastle. Helen has recently celebrated her first year in post, and it's going to be hopefully an interesting discussion. We'll talk about all things in the Church of England. So do enjoy this interview now with Bishop Helen Ann Hartley. Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast today is Bishop Helen Ann Hartley, who is the Bishop of Newcastle. Bishop, it's lovely to welcome you to the Godcast. How are you?
Hi, Alex. It's really good to see you. I've watched so many Godcasts and seen so many clips of it that to actually be in it is something of a real privilege. So I'm really, really happy to be here.
Well, the feeling's mutual. I've been looking to get you on for quite a while, and it's great to finally get you on. So, and probably a good place to start, Bishop Helen, is that you're celebrating a year in the role, aren't you, up in Newcastle? How's that year been for you?
That's right. Yeah, gosh, it's just it's actually been a sort of interesting year of anniversary. So I had my 10th anniversary of being a bishop in February, in the 22nd of Feb, and then exactly 2 months after that, April the 22nd, 1 year as being Bishop of Newcastle. And it's been quite a year. It's been really full. It's been really busy. There's a lot has happened, and I think a lot of it for me is a sense of homecoming. So it's been just a real joy to reconnect with my northeastern roots. That's probably been the best bit of it, actually.
Just share with people who don't know your roots, Helen, and where are they originate from?
Yeah, so I was actually born in Edinburgh. So north of the border, because my dad at the time was a Church of Scotland minister in the borders. So I spent the first 2.5 years of my life in Coldingham, which is right on the coast in the Scottish borders, Coldingham with St. Abbs. And when I was about 2.5, my parents moved to Sunderland, where my dad had a job lecturing at what was then Sunderland Polytechnic. So Sunderland really became home, and that's where I grew up and went to school. And my parents still live in Durham, actually. So lots of roots still in the northeast. But there's been a bit of banter, I have to say, about the Bishop of Newcastle growing up in Sunderland. But you know, I kind of had to say I come in peace.
You can't avoid it.
You can't.
Burnley and Blackburn, Liverpool and Everton, every town and city's got that rivalry. And what some people might not be aware is that, as you said, you've been a bishop for 10 years and you were out in New Zealand for a while, weren't you? Just tell us how that came about. And also, if you could perhaps share some of the differences or maybe some of the similarities between working in New Zealand, actually working in the northeast of England.
Yeah, so I had a friend. I was teaching at in theological college, so theological education is my background, really, in Oxford at Cuddesdon. And I had a friend who I met who actually taught in a theological college in Auckland, in New Zealand, in the North Island. And she said to me, "Oh, why don't you come and do a sabbatical here at some point?" And I was kind of due, I think, for a sabbatical. That would be in 2010. So I ended up spending 3 months at this college, St. John's College in Auckland, and it was an amazing 3 months because it just sort of really changed my perspective on all sorts of things. I mean, I think, you know, at the very least, when you're kind of living in the Southern Hemisphere, when the seasons are all out of sync, it sort of really forces you to inhabit life in a different way. So that's a really sort of minor thing in some ways. But anyway, I enjoyed that experience immensely, but came back home to England and thought that was a great experience to have. You know, let's crack on. And then a job came up at the college in Auckland, and I just had this overwhelming sense of God saying, "You have to apply for this." And thankfully, my husband Miles was up for the adventure. So I applied for that job teaching New Testament and got it. And so we moved to Auckland in the beginning of 2012. And then about a year and a bit later, some people approached me from a diocese in the North Island, the Diocese of Waikato and Taranaki, and said, we think you should be our next bishop. Would you mind if we put your name forward for election? Because they elect bishops in New Zealand. So it's very unlike the process in the Church of England. And I thought, well, this is so unlikely and it's never going to happen. But all right, then, if you think I'm capable of doing that, then by all means. And of course, it did. It did happen. So I became Bishop of Waikato in 2014, and then we moved to Hamilton, which is a city about an hour and a half south of Auckland, and that's where I became bishop. And I think it was interesting because at that time, obviously, the Church of England was still very much debating about whether it should have women as bishops here, and that vote had failed initially, and it was around about that time that I was elected bishop in New Zealand. So there was a sort of interesting way in which the New Zealand church had women in positions of being a bishop for quite some time, actually, mm-hmm. Albeit not many, just one, the Bishop of Dunedin, Penny Jameson. So I think for me, and you know, in a nutshell, one of the big differences, I guess, in the New Zealand context is the way in which, as a society, that culture has wrestled with issues of colonialism. And the New Zealand Anglican Church is structured in a very intentional way to enable the voice of the indigenous people, the Maori, to be really to the fore and really taking a lead alongside what's called the Pākehā bit of the church. That's a Maori word for European, and also the Pacific Island part of the church, because the province there also includes the wonderful islands of Fiji and Tonga and Samoa. So I think I was just sort of immersed in this incredible multicultural context that was really wrestling with some of the legacy issues around colonialism, mm. which is something that not really taught about so much in school here. So I think that for me was a real eye-opener and a challenge, but also a huge, huge blessing. And I think it completely changed me because of that.
It's really nice to hear, because I think I'm guilty of this, of sometimes being a bit colloquial. You know, you're from the town where you're from, and you kind of, you know, and I think it's important for Christians. I'm trying to encourage Christians in our church to think wider and hear stories from across the land, wherever that may be. Were there, or are there, many similarities between the respective ministries there and here?
Yeah, there are. I mean, there's kind of a core DNA in terms of being a bishop. You know, it's still a role of oversight. There's far less, in the New Zealand context, far less infrastructure. So no archdeacons, no area deans. I mean, there's and fewer clergy, huge parishes. You know, the diocese where I was bishop, you'd think nothing on a Sunday morning of getting in the car and driving two and a half hours, mm. 3 hours to get to a parish visit and back again. So sort of the landscape was really, you know, very, very much focused on, just for me, as much as I could, getting around, offering pastoral support, leadership, connecting with the small number of Anglican schools that we had. And, you know, because it's obviously the New Zealand, well, I say obviously, but the New Zealand church, Anglican church, is not the established church in New Zealand. So you really have to, as it were, earn credibility in the public square. You can't take it for granted in the way that I think we might occasionally do in the Church of England. So I think similarities, I mean, the core DNA of liturgy, good old Anglican service is an Anglican service, although in the New Zealand context, you'd have a lot of it in the Maori language and in Pacific Island languages. Yeah. And there, particularly the Pacific Island, vibrancy and colour in singing and worship was something that was truly inspiring. So, yeah, a lot of similarities, but a lot of differences. And I think it really made me appreciate the breadth and the diversity of the Anglican communion and how enriching that is for us here.
Yeah. Just in my ears, I can kind of hear people saying, come on, Father Alex, get on with it. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty, what everybody's talking about in the Church of England. And I will get to that, I promise.
Yeah, but sure.
I think it's important to share these things, actually. I think it's important for people to learn the bigger picture of somebody's story and what's happened. Just, and I'm also conscientious, Helen Ann, that people always talk about the downside of the church. Just if you could share some of the things that are really inspiring you in the Northeast, that you're kind of, wow, this is wonderful. This is wonderful to be part of the church at this time regarding this matter.
So the northeast has, the reality is that a lot of the statistics around issues of poverty, particularly children living in poverty, and the way in which people are really, really struggling. I mean, you'll know this from your context, Alex. I know because you've written about it, you've spoken about it a lot. So many of those stories are stories that I see here, and just that sense of injustice and the need to sort of to advocate for lifting people out of some of that, terribleness and awfulness. And that's a really important part of my role. But what really inspires me is the way in which communities are working with a sense of resilience and commitment to place. And I think that inspires me because, it's about the wonderful thing about the parish system is the kind of rootedness in place and the way in which I see clergy and people and churches really reaching into their communities in a way that's about partnership and about making a difference. And I think some of the work that I see happening, particularly in the food bank in Newcastle, which I've become the patron of recently, that started in one of our churches, St James's Church in Benwell, and just seeing the way in which that networks community across the city, working in partnership with the Newcastle United Foundation, with all sorts of other food banks, food community pantries. In some ways, I wish none of that existed or had to exist, but what really inspires me is the way in which people, often in their own initiative, respond to need, but in a way that actually is about spreading the good news of Jesus and the gospel, because that's it in action. And that day-to-day really inspires me.
I wonder what you think about moving that process on, or that argument and that discussion on. What you've described is reminiscent of the community outreach in Burnley that goes on in the various churches and community groups, from the secular as well as the people of faith, is remarkable, and it's inspiring. But in some ways, it's a plaster of the problem, isn't it? I mean, I've been speaking to community food banks just recently, and they are really struggling, because they're having to pay now, because people
That's
aren't in a
right.
position to donate. And I wonder how we move that argument on. And I think it builds into the whole conversation of inequality, doesn't it? I was interested. You'd posted something about children's homes, that hadn't you, in the northeast, and how the percentage in the north is just horrendous, really. And I sometimes think we have to dig deep on these matters. This is children's futures we're talking about, isn't it? Just wondering what your thoughts were.
I think so. Last, I mean, so recently I was, there's an all-party parliamentary group, the Child of the North, which I've become a member of through my role in the House of Lords. And just recently they launched a report on children in care. And I think, some of the statistics around that are really confronting. And it's really quite shocking. And it is in many ways both challenging the sticking plaster element, but then actually really saying that there are some really systemic issues underlying this that just can't be addressed by putting a sticking plaster on, because there are issues around poverty, around inequality, and this goes back generations. And I think that's part of the challenge, is how you catch up with all of that. And the fact that it's impacting children today, children who will grow into teenage, into adulthood, and won't be lifted out of those being stuck in that system of poverty. Well, that I mean, we just that's just a scandal, And I think I can say that, and that's great. But actually, now in the role I'm in, I'm determined to try and use it to actually make a difference. And I'm not naive in that, because I really think that the North generally, the northeast where I am, be the northwest where you are, there are some chronic issues that do need it is like the Magnificat, isn't it? The meek shall be lifted up and the high laid low. And I think, that's not just a political statement, that's a statement of justice and of mercy, and that's what we're about.
Does it ever surprise you that people don't get it? I mean, what one thing that I certainly through writing the book, was meant to people who contacted me and almost said, "Is it? I don't believe it's like that. Is it possible?" You know, I've written something this week for the Church Times where people have challenged me already, and I just think you just don't get it, you know. And maybe we can talk about class towards the end of the interview. Yeah. I just think people are so living in a different world; they don't understand. I mean, there's the healer, there's the putting them back together as a human being, and then there's trying to get some what I think call some Christian love into them, which makes them heal longer term than they might otherwise, you know. Do you see that yourself?
Yeah, I think I see. So how I would respond to that is, I mean, it's kind of anecdotal in a way, but occasionally when I meet people in London, saying they're like, "Oh, where are you from? Newcastle. Oh, wow, that's so far away." You know, it's almost like I must have set off a week before to actually end up in London. It's like, well, it's not actually that far away. They think the north ends, you know, the sense of we've got Newcastle, but there's quite a long way up to the Scottish border, which is also under my oversight. And let's not forget that there are quite significant issues of poverty in rural communities as well as in urban communities. So I think it does surprise me that people don't get it. And I think that just underlines that a lot of people have lived such privileged lives that it's just not on their radar. There's no comprehension that somebody could be in work but still need a food bank. You know, how does that happen? That is the reality. You know, that is the reality. And that I think that it's that area of inequality and injustice that really does bother me, that there are good people I know who work really hard, several jobs, but still very much need the food bank or the food pantry.
Yeah, yeah, it is quite harrowing and shocking and yeah. Well, let's move on to other matters. Can we talk about safeguarding? I know this is an area that you are outspoken and you are passionate about. And one of the things I admire about you, Helen Anne, is you kind of, you safeguarding, I believe, with you is a non-negotiable, you know, and I think I obviously don't want to get into the issue with the former Archbishop of York, but, you know, what's your assessment of the overarching position of the Church of England, and what do we need to do to kind of turn it round and actually be seen as a really positive? I mean, I was embarrassed to be at General Synod last summer. I mean, that was just a mess. It was a complete and utter fiasco. And we seem to make these inroads, don't we? But then we shoot ourselves in the foot quite frequently. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, just that. Just that phrase, I think, because, you know, I think particularly, yeah, I mean, last July in York was just dreadful and really shocking, really shocking. And then this February in London, well, I mean, I'm still shocked, actually, because I thought that with the Jay report would be embraced with, yes, okay, she's been sent off to do a piece of work, she's done it, she's recommended that we move to full independence. Let's do that, because I think it's an opportunity for the church to show, for once, leadership and actually potentially set up an independent body that other denominations, other faith groups could then participate in. And how amazing would that be if we actually showed initiative for all our failings in safeguarding, in having that set up? And I was, you know, very much informed in that by conversations with my own safeguarding advisor officer here, and her confidence in pursuing an independent track. And I was flabbergasted that I was very much in the minority and amongst my Episcopal colleagues. And I wasn't expecting to speak at all in that debate, because I just thought, well, it's going to go through. And when it wasn't, and then when an amendment was moved, I remember sitting at my computer, my laptop, and just typed up this really, really quick, you know, you do really quick speech, and stood up to speak and was asked to speak. And my goodness. I mean, in some ways, Alex, I'm still processing what happened, because I I am very much in a minority in the House of Bishops around this, and I just find that really distressing and embarrassing, if I'm honest.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, why do I think that is? Could do a psychological analysis on it. I could say that in two ways. So one way, I think my perspective is very much informed as a bishop of a diocese that is quite forward-looking and quite pioneering in the work with victims and survivors. So I'm kind of being formed as a diocesan bishop in a context where we're really open about safeguarding, about how we change the narrative, how we improve all the time and learn all the time, and particularly attend to the needs of victims and survivors. So that in a sense provides me with a sort of benchmark, which is pretty high in terms of what we can do. And I think maybe it's that a number of my colleagues are just fearful, don't want to lose control. I think it's issues around that, which is in some ways a human failing, which becomes an institutional failing. And I think we've seen that in safeguarding many, many times. We still see it, that human failings lead to institutional failings, which is a sort of perpetual cycle of despair, which actually is a really unhealthy place to be. So I think a lot of the Church of England is still stuck in that cycle of wanting to control and to have power and not to lose face. And I think that's at the heart of it, sadly. Yeah.
do you think there's an element of fear of what actually might be revealed if we become a transparent church?
It could be that. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think fear of what could be revealed, fear of being found out, fear of failings being exposed, fear of the unknown, which is both that, but also what might be lost if we allow others to be responsible for our safeguarding. In my sense, we've got nothing to lose, but everything to gain.
Yeah, and I suppose there's some concern that, you know, this is a criticism of diocesan safeguarding management and procedures, but that, you know, we're not saying that, are we? We're saying, you know, these we respect that some excellent work going on within the church now.
Absolutely.
It's about how we make us more transparent, more safe. I mean, the other thing I often think about it is what irritates me is that the fact that we even have to consider an independent safeguarding body. You know, we're supposed to be the church, aren't we? There's supposed to be people to love one another, and we're meant to be the example to one another. And I think these issues need resolutions, as LLF, as we'll get on to in a minute. These need to be clarified, don't they? Because they are deep wounds, and it's very difficult to move forward while the wound's still open.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you said that word, bring clarity, and I think that's a really favourite word of mine, partly informed by my time working with the Bishop of Leeds. That was one of his favourite words. And clarity, you know, it builds confidence, and it also fosters an environment of trust, because people have confidence. And I think we just don't have that at the moment with our safeguarding in the Church of England. And I get that there are obvious anxieties around some of the issues connected with the Jay report and employment and all that sort of thing. And those can be worked through, but that's not enough to not embrace what we could gain by becoming independent with our safeguarding.
And do you think we're any nearer a resolution now, or are we a bit like LLF, well, kind of back to where we started from?
So I think at the moment we're getting the classic Church of England response. You can see it with LLF, that it's just, you know, let's set up another group, let's have a bit more consultation, let's think a bit more about this. And what that means to me is, let's just not do this at the moment, because we need to just delay it a bit. And I found that's quite a strong word, delay, but I think delay and obfuscation are what I see happening at the moment. And that's why, you know, I will keep on speaking up and speaking out. You know, I won't be silenced on this, as attempts have been made to silence me, and I, you know, I'm not going to be intimidated, because I do think this is a really, really important matter, and a bishop needs to speak up about that. I think it's part of the leadership role.
I agree, and talking about that, let's move on to LLF, something else you're not afraid to speak up and speak out about. You know, my just thinking about what you said there, Helen, and about clarity. You know, I'd like to think lots of clergy, your clergy, come from a place of integrity, but I like to be transparent. So, right from the beginning of this whole procedure, I've said I'm not a fan of LLF. I think it's kicking the can down the road. I've also said that I'm affirming of same-sex relationships. I'm part of an inclusive church. But I've also said that if you don't hold the same view as I do, then that's fine. I can respect that and I can live with that difference. And we are now in a situation where I really don't know what is going on. Mm-hmm. You were the lead bishop for LLF. Maybe slightly shorter than Liz Truss was prime minister. I'm not sure. and the reasons why you relinquished that position are public and people can read about them. But what is your evaluation of where we are now and what is being proposed? I was looking this morning with updates. We've got a program board. We've got the PLF group. We've got the pastoral guide group. We've got the pastoral reassurance group. Goodness me, my view is when, if ever. I mean, just to finish, my points is, you know, this is a prayer of blessing. This is, you know, we're not talking about a change to doctrine. No. Bearing in mind that we've gone through the process with the ordination of women and the remarriaging of divorced couples. Mm. Is this simply about sex that's the problem?
I think you've probably hit the proverbial nail on the head. I think there's some deep, deep-rooted issues around shame, around discomfort with, I don't know what it is. I don't want to over sort of psychologically analyze it, but I do think that if you strip away the layers of how people use and misuse biblical texts over this, how people use and misuse words like doctrine and theology to sort of cloak what is, I think, just pure homophobia or transphobia. And that's, you know, these things need to be named and called out because they are simply not biblical. They're not of God. That's not about God's kingdom. That's not about the flourishing of people. It's about a very deep-rooted almost hatred towards difference, or how that's then threatening people's own sense of masculinity or whatever. It's just, there are some real deep-rooted human issues going on there that I think end up being the things that then drive how the church responds, and then again drives how we just seem to be hell-bent on delaying things and not providing clarity. Back to that word clarity that we said earlier. Yeah, it's not hard.
And you will have people in your own diocese, Bishop, where you are the lead, who will hold a different view. Mm-hmm. How do you make that workable? You know, because we're trying to make it workable on a national level. Mm. How do you make it work on a diocesan level? I'm sure you'll have had critique and letters and emails. What's your way of response?
So I'm very comfortable with people holding different views on matters. I think that's fine. And in many ways, my time in New Zealand, the way in which the New Zealand church was able to hold together at times some profound differences over all sorts of matters. And yet, for example, on this issue of human sexuality, come to a sort of sensible resolution around dioceses making decisions about whether they could or could not bless people in same-sex marriages, civil relationships, or particularly marriages in the New Zealand context. So I'm very comfortable with people holding a different view from me, because I like to think my door's open, you know, come and talk to me. And I have had conversations with a few clergy that don't hold the same view. I've sat down and looked at biblical texts together, and actually we found a sense of profound walking together, a bit like from some of my postgraduate study in rabbinic studies, the way in which Jewish rabbis could kind of walk together and argue about texts, but actually they could hold together difference and they would hold together in that. They wouldn't break apart. So I think keeping dialogue open, keeping conversation open is great. But the problem is when you start institutionalizing that in the way in which LLF is doing, then you get a control mechanism that I think actually leads us in a path towards schism rather than a path towards actually we can walk together on this and hold different views, but we can still have clarity that this is the way the church is going in terms of affirming people in their same-sex relationships, same-sex committed relationships.
Yeah, and in that clarity, and when you know, when the legal framework of the Church of England passes something, as it did in February, and over a year later, when you know it's been that's what's been voted for, but it's not actually formalised and actively encouraged. That then damages the credibility of the church, surely.
Oh, it does, absolutely. And I think what's really frustrating is that we get a sort of, oh, but the vote was really close, you know, it was passed, but oh, it was really close, so therefore we can't. I think, well, but that's our structure. We had the debate, a long debate, and that was the outcome. And if anything, that is a mandate to have clarity while at the same time acknowledging that we need to walk together and there's still stuff to be worked through, but there's still the clarity because we had the vote. So you can't just keep saying, oh, but it was close.
What's your thoughts on arrogance regarding this matter, Bishop? I mean, one of the things that irritates me is that about General Synod is that I feel that people give the impression that this really matters to the world. You know, but the reality of the church is we are in dramatically decreasing numbers. Mm-hmm. We have lost our credibility over matters of, I don't even want to say living in love and faith, gay couples, gay relationships.
Yeah,
we've lost our credibility around safeguarding.
Yeah.
But there are people in church think that we've got this, we hold the upper hand. What we say means something. I was really struck by how little it was reported on, actually, the last synod in the media.
Yeah.
I almost think they're getting a bit fed up with it.
What's
the way, what is going to happen? What is the way forward? Can you shine some light?
Can I shine some light? I wish I could. I think, first of all, you make a really important point about credibility I think the church has lost huge credibility in the public square, and you see it from time to time in the political sphere, when Parliament puts questions to the Second Estates Commissioner, who has to sort of get all a bit uncomfortable and answer them. And I think because I operate now in that political sphere and in the role I occupy in the House of Lords, I really sometimes acutely aware of when I'm talking to peers who I know are very progressive on same-sex matters, you know, I have to kind of quite quickly get into the conversation my own views, which are more progressive than where the church institutionally seems to be at the moment. And because I feel really quite like guilty and anxious about that. And it's terrible. And actually, you know, the world, society has moved on these matters, and there are far more pressing issues, some of which we've already talked about earlier, around poverty, around children, around aspiration, around injustices. And you know, this is where I want to be putting my energy, and this is where General Synod should be putting its energy, not hours and hours of endless debate about faithful, committed people in same-sex relationships who are doing absolutely no harm whatsoever to either themselves or society or God, but are rather living the best lives that they can and being a witness to faithfulness in a way that I think I find inspiring and humbling. So how will all of this resolve? I hope to God that it will resolve with clarity, and that we can actually say yes to people who want to offer themselves at the moment just for a blessing of their same-sex relationship. You know, and the arguments about, oh, well, you can't bless what God doesn't bless. I'm sorry, but I think God does bless people who want to commit their lives to one another, because God has created these precious human beings in God's image, and that surely is something that we have to affirm.
Yeah, I could say a lot of things. You know, my associate priest is in a civil partnership, and when she came, there was concern, there was worry, and I just said, you know, just judge her for what she does, not for what she is, please.
Yeah, yes.
And they've done that, and they absolutely adore her and love her and a partner. And I think that's possibly the way forward, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a really hopeful way of saying, how is it going to end? It's going to end by by people bearing witness to who they are. But my goodness, there's a cost on lives too in that. So I think it's about paying attention to that, which is why the advocacy for the clarity that needs to be brought is something that, you know, you and I still need to speak up about.
Yeah. Gosh, I've just looked at the time and it's absolutely flown by, but there's a couple of things I just want to ask if I can.
Yeah.
One is Theo Hobson, who writes for The Spectator,
yes,
said that liberal theologians need to stop being so nice. And it's okay to actually upset people sometimes. Mm. Do you think there's an element of truth in that? Do you actually need them to say, this is what we're doing, this is our position, let's get on with it?
I'd like to think that I'm a nice person, but I'm also quite robust. And I, you know, I'm not afraid to call things out, not in a way that's unduly provocative, but actually it's because that's what I truly believe the justice of the gospel is about. And it's not in a way that's shouty. It's a way that is just simply bearing witness to the good news of God. And yes, I think we do need to be proactive in that sphere.
Yeah. Thank you. And kind of the thing that I just want to ask for comment on briefly is, you know, one thing I'm really passionate about is inequality, is the working class representation in the church, which is nowhere near where it needs to be. But particularly as I've written about it in the Church Times this week, about vocations of the working classes into our church. You're in the Northeast, mm-hmm. which is a place that I've spent some time, very fond of, love the whole of the North. And, you know, there is a huge shortfall of ordinands in the church. And we quite often, absolutely rightly so, talk about attracting people from the LGBTQI community, from the BAME community. But I was intrigued to learn that just this week, speaking with Nick McKee, that there's no national strategy for vocations from the working classes, which, you know, that's got to be in my bonnet now. That's gone in there, and it's like, whoa, what's going on?
But there is
much work to do, isn't there,
in
reaching out and getting into that untapped potential. Are you doing anything in Newcastle regarding that? Or
I completely agree with you, and so one of the things I was charged with coming into this role was, and it is one of the Church of England's taglines, is the younger and more diverse, and actually really delving into what do we mean really by that. And you've mentioned some of the ways in which the church is proactive in that sphere, and I've, you know, we do have in Newcastle some amazing vocations of people that are very much in working class contexts and are ministering then back into. And I'm quite intentional at the moment, as we're developing our vision and strategy, particularly around encouraging people to be disciples, how I want to develop a sort of lay discipling program, but place it in hubs, not in the places that you might think. So in some of the, like, where church houses in Newcastle, in Percy Main, in Biker, you know, in places where there are some fantastic people, absolutely brilliant people, and actually igniting in them that sense of, yes, God calls you, actually in that place authentically responding to that and giving them the tools and the resources, equipping them, resourcing them, really, really important. So that's definitely part of what fires me, partly because I've, you know, I appreciate that I'm talking to you with a few theology degrees and including a doctorate and all that sort of thing, but I wouldn't call myself a natural academic theologian, and for me it only really matters when it connects with people in a very real way, which is why for me communication is a really important thing. So, you know, I do pause for thought on Radio 2, and I'm definitely more of a Radio 2 person than I would be like a Radio 4 thought for the day person, if you see what I mean. So I'm actually myself becoming increasingly interested in some of those issues that you're talking about. So I really hope that the church can be more intentional and more fruitful in that area, because there's huge, huge potential.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Bishop Helen. And I'm sure people are screaming at me going, you should have asked her this, but you know, we only have so much time. It's been really lovely talking to you. I know, what do you like to do when you're not bishoping, Bishop? You know, I know you're a keen runner, aren't you? What other interests?
Yeah, running is my thing. So park run. I've just started training properly now for the Great North Run in September. I did it last year and didn't train, and it was okay. But I thought, actually, if I make an effort and train properly, I might enjoy it a bit more. So yeah, that definitely for me, running is the thing that for mental health, for clearing my head, for wearing shorts and trainers is a great leveler. if you see what I mean, when you're out and about. So that's definitely the thing that I like to do.
Fabulous. Yeah, lovely. Well, thanks ever so much for coming on.
Thanks, Alex.
And I hope everybody's enjoyed this. You can find lots more interviews. There's tons of theologians and bishops and musicians and footballers and pop stars and all sorts of people. So just check out the Godcast. But for now, Bishop Helen Ann Hartley, thanks so much for coming on the Godcast. Thank you.
Thanks, Alex.